body more tightly in her hands. Also, she cries all the time. She says she misses her baby.
Her baby?
The girl was watching her mother talk. She was like a rabbit in a field, listening. Her little boy. She cries and cries. I want my baby, she says. Anderson felt his heart begin to beat a little faster. His mind, though, remained apart.
How long has she been saying this?
1 year, maybe. We tell her to forget about it. My husband says it's bad luck to think of another life. But still, she talks. She smiled sadly, put down the knife, and stood up, as if wiping her hands of the matter. The men stood, too.
Just a few more questions.
But she was shaking her head, still smiling, retreating through a door in the rear of the room. They watched her shadowy figure stirring something on a low charcoal stove. The child sat at the table, stroking the doll's absurd hair, humming tunelessly. Anderson leaned across the table.
Guy, your mother said you used to live in Pitchett. Can you tell me about this?
Angsley translated. Anderson held his breath. They waited. The girl ignored them, playing with her doll. Its blank button eyes seemed to be mocking them. Anderson walked over to Guy, squatting down next to her chair. She had her mother's high cheekbones under the circles of white powder and her mother's anxious eyes. He eased himself onto the floor and pulled his long legs into a cross-legged position. For a long time, 15 minutes, he simply sat with her. Guy showed him the doll, and he smiled. They began to play silently. She fed the doll and gave it to him to feed.
Nice baby, he said after a while.
She tweaked the doll's painted nose affectionately.
A really pretty baby.
Anderson's voice was gentle, admiring. He followed Angsley's high tones floating up and down like paper airplanes borne haltingly up and then falling, missing their mark. Who knew if he was saying it correctly? She giggled.
It's a boy, Angsley translated.
Does he have a name?
Nang.
Nice name.
He paused.
What are you feeding him?
Milk.
Doesn't he like rice?
She shook her head. She was only a few inches away from him. He could smell the papaya on her breath and a chalky smell, possibly from the face paint.
Why not?
She grimaced.
Rice is bad.
It doesn't taste good?
No, 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 not good.
He waited a moment.
Did something happen while you were eating rice?
A bad thing happened.
Oh.
He was aware of all the sounds in the room. Angsley's voice, the scratching of the lizards as they raced madly across the ceiling, the quick clicks of his heartbeat.
What happened?
Not now.
I see. It happened in another time.
When I was big.
Anderson looked at the sun sliding through the slats onto the wooden floor, the white circles glowing on the child's face.
Oh, when you were big. Did you live in a different house?
She nodded.
In Pitchett.
I see.
He forced himself to breathe evenly.
What happened there?
Bad thing.
A bad thing happened with the rice?
She reached over the table to the papaya bowl, grabbed a piece of papaya, and shoved it into her mouth.
What happened, Guy?
She smiled at them with the fruit covering her teeth, the broad orange smile of a clown. She shook her head. They waited for a long time, but she said nothing else. Out the window, the water buffalo was no longer in sight. The sun set the bright fields on fire. Down below, the chickens chuckled at them.
I guess that's it, then, Angsley said.
Wait.
The girl was reaching again into the bowl of papaya, and this time she took the paring knife her mother had left there. She picked it up with her imperfect hand. They were so rapt, these two grown men watching her,
They didn't react at first. They didn't take the knife away from the baby. They watched her pick up the doll, wrap its crude cloth fingers carefully around the knife, and with one focused movement, turn the knife toward her body, stopping just before it entered her abdomen, its point grazing the wine-colored birthmark. It was only then that Anderson reached over, prying the knife from her tiny, malformed fingers. She let him take it. She said something else. She was looking up at him, her face urgent beneath the white powder. A ghost child, thought Anderson. A dream. And then he thought, no, she's real. This is reality. There was a pause.
Well?
What is it?
What did she say?
Angsley frowned slightly.
I think she said, the postman.
It was late in the day by the time Anderson and Angsley headed back in the boat. The hired truck that had taken them to and from Pitchett had let them off at the riverbank, and now they were returning silently to Bangkok. Anderson stood in the front. Next to him, Angsley sat and smoked. The boat glided past the shacks with jetties, little spirit houses perched on the ends, miniature temples built for the shelter and appeasement of ghosts, past the women bathing, the children swimming in the muddy river water. Anderson unbuttoned his shirt. He took off his shoes and socks. He needed to feel the water sloshing his toes, splashing his ankles. He stood on the boat in his open shirt and t-shirt, the late afternoon sun roaring on his head. Every hair on his body was standing on end. He thought of Arjuna, begging the Hindu god Krishna to show him reality. Reality, the fire of a thousand suns simultaneously blazing forth in the sky. He thought of Heraclitus. A man cannot step in the same river twice, for it is not the same river, and he is not the same man. He thought of the police and coroner's reports about the mailman from Pitchett, who had plunged a knife into the left side of his wife's abdomen, killing her and cutting through three of the protecting fingers of her right hand, because she had burned the rice. The boat driver did something to the motor, and the boat skittered forward, skipping over the river, dousing them with its cooling spray. He remembered his college self, when he and Angsley had stayed up late discussing the case of Shanti Devi and the writings of Plato and anyone else who had taken a theory of reincarnation to heart, from Origen and Henry Ford to General Patton and the Buddha. He thought he'd given up all that. The survival of consciousness after death. It was a holy grail or a pipe dream, unfit work for a scientist of his caliber. Yet he had been searching since then in his own way, keeping track of what J.B. Rhine's people were doing with ESP at Duke, and exploring in his own work the connections between the mind and the body. Mental stress caused physical ailments. That much was certain. But why did some people emerge from trauma resiliently, while others became plagued with night sweats and phobias? It was clear to him that genetics and environmental factors did not explain everything. He did not believe that it was a question of luck. He was searching for something else. Something else. Connection spawned connection in his mind, branching outward like glass shattering. Not just nature or nurture, but something else that could cause personality quirks, phobias. Why some babies were born calm and others inconsolable. Why some children had innate attractions and abilities. Why others felt they should have been a member of the opposite sex. Why Chang, the irritable Siamese twin, who liked to drink and carouse, was so different in his nature from his easygoing, teetotaler brother, Ang. Surely the genetics and environmental factors in that case were the same. And birth defects, of course. The girl's deformed fingers provided a clear link between this life and another one, and might even explain Owen. Anderson sat down. His throat was parched. The sun had scalded him on the skin of his nose and cheeks and neck, and he knew he would suffer badly later. When he closed his eyes, he could see formless shapes moving quickly across a too bright expanse of orange. The shapes coalesced into a face that was not a face, and he let himself see his child again.
Sheila had accused him of an inability to love Owen during his brief, tortured life, because he could not bring himself to hold and stroke the baby as she did. True, he couldn't look at his son, but it was because he loved him and was so powerless to help him. He was tormented by his ignorance. Why should this happen to this child in this way? In the hospital before Sheila had awakened, he had stroked the tiny hand of his imperfect child, and he had looked into that terrible, innocent face until he couldn't look at it any longer, or ever again. He had walked right out of the NICU and down the hallway into the maternity ward, to the window behind which the other babies slept and fussed, their bodies brightly pink with health. Why? For no clear reason, one baby comes out the way Owen had, and others come out perfectly. What sense was there in it? What science? Could it really be simple bad luck? An unfortunate turn of chromosomal roulette? Why was this child born this way, when there were no genetic indicators, no environmental factors at all? Unless... He opened his eyes. Bobby Angsley was watching him, a faint smile playing at the corners of his lips.
I've been tracking this phenomenon, Angsley said quietly. In Nigeria, in Turkey, Alaska, Lebanon. You thought I was playing. Well, I was playing. But I was looking, too. And listening.
And you heard something?
Mostly whispers. Stories told late at night over raki or village moonshine with visiting anthropologists. Some of the women are surprisingly comely, you know, in a sexy Margaret Mead kind of way.
Right.
Anderson rolled his eyes and shifted his wet feet into the sunlight.
No, listen,
Angsley said quickly, and his intensity made Anderson look up.
Did you know there's an Igbo village in Nigeria in which they amputate the little finger of a deceased child, asking him to come back, only if he'll live a longer life with them next time round? And when they subsequently have a child, and that child has a deformed little finger, which apparently actually happens sometimes, they rejoice. And the Tlingit of Alaska, they're dying or dead, appear to them in dreams, telling them which female relative's body will give birth to them. And don't get me started on the Druze.
He jammed his cigarette between his lips as if to restrain himself physically from continuing, and then took it out again.
Look, I know it sounds like folklore, but there are cases.
Cases?
Anderson tried to fathom what Angsley was telling him. There were layers beneath layers.
Verifiable cases? Well, I'm no Charles Darwin. I'm not a very good scientist of any kind, as it turns out. I lack rigor.
Anderson stared at him.
You didn't bring me out here just for the girl.
Angsley looked back at him simply.
No.
His eyes were glowing with fervor. They rounded a bend in the river, and the city appeared before them like a gift, the golden stupas of the royal palace, the glinting red and green temple roofs. If they could do it, if they had verifiable cases, then they would be able to do what nobody yet had done, not William James, not John Edgar Coover at Stanford, not J.B. Ryan at Duke, who shut himself in the lab all those years with his ESP cards. They would have found evidence of the survival of consciousness after death.
We'll need to go back tomorrow, first thing in the morning, Anderson said slowly.
He was working it out as he spoke.
We'll get the girl and bring her to Pitchett, see what she can identify. I'll meet you in the lobby at 5:30.
Angsley chuckled and swore softly.
All right.
There was a pause. Anderson could scarcely breathe.
Bobby,
Anderson murmured.
There are really other cases like this one?
Angsley smiled. He inhaled on his cigarette and let forth a long plume of smoke. The light on the stupas was blinding in the setting sun, but Anderson couldn't stop looking. He could hardly wait until morning.
There was so much work to be done.
Recalculating.
How many times had the GPS said that? Where was he? He'd taken a wrong turn somewhere, Anderson pulled over to the side of the muddy road and got out of the car. Trucks zoomed by him on the highway, which stank of asphalt, exhaust, a false sense of importance. America. He looked around for road signs. Last he'd noticed, he'd been somewhere outside of Philadelphia. How far had he gone astray? He tried to shake the sights and sounds of Thailand out of his head. He felt his friend's presence near him, as if he had just left his side. His best friend, gone now. It was all gone. The Institute, that fine edifice he and Angsley and Angsley's money had built. And what excitement they'd had in building it, when the field was theirs to discover, and the cases flowed one after the other, sending them off to Thailand, Sri Lanka, Lebanon, India, each case compelling and new. They'd had a good ride of it, too, until Angsley died suddenly, 6 months after Sheila, walking up a hillside on his property in Virginia, his heart seizing and stopping, just like that. At the wake, Catholic, traditional, Anderson should have known right then that the widow would slowly drain the money from the foundation like the blood in her husband's veins. There was a look of surprise stamped on Angsley's face, even the funeral director hadn't been able to erase. Oh, my friend, he had thought, looking at that familiar body plumped with formaldehyde, rouge on its cheeks, headed for the family mausoleum. Not the burial you'd imagined. Your old bones bare on a cliff, gleaming in the sun. Oh, my friend, you beat me to it. Now you know, and I don't. Angsley was dead. The Institute was closed, its files shipped off. There was only one thing left to do, only one more case to investigate. All he had to do was finish it.
Chapter 16. Asheview, Virginia, made Janie nervous. It was a suburb of D.C., full of the kind of Stepford McMansions she had always scorned. Homes lacking any sense of history, taking up every inch of the space allotted with vast, unwieldy garages. And yet, she had to admit there might be something enticing for a child in these new, oversized houses. The large, bright green front yards, the oak trees that line the streets too neatly, their green branches arching over the road. They had driven down the main street a few times. They stopped by three different schools, one of which apparently was Tommy Moran's. Each was appealing in its own way with its large ball field and playground. "Do you recognize anything?" Anderson kept asking. But Noah said nothing. He seemed stunned, distracted, watching the buildings from the back seat, murmuring to himself every now and then in a sing-song voice, "Asheview, Asheview." "We've been through here already," Janie said to Anderson. He had picked them up at the station and proceeded directly downtown. "One more time. We'll take a different route." He wheeled the car around, and they headed back through the town's thoroughfare. Janie had it memorized by now. Starbucks, pizza place, church, church, bank, gas station, hardware store, town hall, fire department. Sliding by again and again like a town in a dream. She glanced at Anderson. He drove stiffly, his jaw set with a stubborn resolve. He had 24 years on her, and 64 on Noah, and there was no sign of fatigue in him. "I'm not sure he recognizes anything." "That's not unusual. Some children are more attached to the actual house than the town. People remember different things." At last he reached a gate. Anderson conferred with a guard who checked a list, and then waved them through. They proceeded slowly down a street flanked by even larger, newer homes. A golf course gleamed in the hills beyond them. Anderson pulled up to the huge brick home that reminded Janie of a plain woman burdened with too many accessories. The only sign of human life was a plastic dump truck by the stone path to the front door, its wheels in the air like an upended beetle. They sat silently in the car. Janie watched her son in the rearview mirror. His expression was unreadable to her. "Well," Anderson said at last, "here we are." "They're rich." Janie said suddenly. Tommy was rich. She felt it like a blow.
It seems so.
Anderson managed a tense smile. Well, no wonder Noah wanted to come back here, she thought. Who wouldn't? So what if the house was poorly designed? Who could be happy with a small two-bedroom on the garden level when you'd had this? Anderson turned toward Noah in the back seat, and his face and voice softened.
Does anything seem familiar to you, Noah?
Noah looked back at him. He seemed a bit glazed over.
I don't know.
Anderson nodded.
Why don't we go in and find out?
Noah seemed to rouse himself. He unlatched his car seat himself and scrambled from the car and up the stone path. A man in a polo shirt and crisp khaki slacks opened the door. He had a ruddy, exasperated face and limp red hair and looked at them all with the dismay of a diabetic facing a troop of cookie-bearing Girl Scouts. Janie tried not to stare at him or at Noah, who was inspecting the man's boat shoes. She restrained herself from saying, "Sweetie, is this your daddy from another life?" And then almost started giggling from sheer nerves. The man glowered at them.
"I guess you all ought to come in," he said at last,
stepping back and holding the door partially open so that they had to angle their bodies to enter. The foyer was the size of her living room in Brooklyn.
"Just so you know, I'm not on board with any of this," he continued. "So if you're expecting any compensation, let me tell—"
"We don't want negotiations,"
Anderson said firmly. Janie realized that he must be nervous, too. He was gripping his briefcase tightly in his hand. The man squinted.
"Excuse me? I meant compensation."
"Right." He waved them into an expansive, great room. Janie tried to relax and simply breathe. There was the scent of something sweet baking in the air, and also something citrusy and antiseptic underneath that caught in her chest. From somewhere deep in the home, a vacuum cleaner hummed. The room was decorated in a tasteful, neutral way with luxurious beige furniture and framed prints of flowers on the walls. Through the sliding glass doors in the back of the room, she could glimpse a large pool covered with a heavy gray tarp. It looked like a scab in the middle of the backyard.
"You're here!"
A tiny blonde woman smiled at them warmly from a balcony overlooking the room. She was balancing a hugely plump baby of about a year on her hip as if he were made of air. She was pretty, with a round face and fine, delicate features. The woman joined the three of them standing awkwardly in front of the fireplace. She smiled graciously at Janie and Anderson, as if they had come for tea, and gave each of them in turn her soft hand. Her hair was held neatly at the nape of her neck, with a cloisonné hair clip that, Janie noted, perfectly matched her silken, canary-yellow blouse.
"Thanks for coming all this way," she said. "I'm Melissa."
Melissa turned to Noah and extended her hand to him as well. He shook it solemnly. The whole room watched them without breathing. The skeptical husband from the doorway, the two anxious adults. Noah scuffed his feet shyly against the carpeting, and Janie noticed unhappily that his left sneaker was sprouting a little hole near the toe. Yet another thing she hadn't been able to stay on top of. Melissa smiled sweetly at Noah.
"Do you like oatmeal raisin cookies?"
Her voice was light and high, like a preschool teacher. Noah nodded, looking up at her with wide eyes.
"I thought you would."
She adjusted her grasp on the baby, jiggling him in her arms.
"They'll be ready soon. I made mint lemonade, too, if you'd like some."
She was so appealing, with her bright blonde hair and wide smile. Like Noah. Any stranger would assume she was the boy's mother. She was the mom you'd pick from a catalog. "I want that one." Anyone would want to go back to this big house and sweet-faced, cookie-making mom. Janie crossed her arms. The skin on the backs of her upper arms was slightly nubby, a medical condition that never quite went away. Noah had the same problem. She wanted to reach out and feel the familiar roughness on his upper arms. "He's mine," she thought. "There's the proof."
"Sit down, won't you?"
Melissa implored.
and they all sank as one into the curving couch. Melissa put the baby on the floor, and they watched him pull himself around the furniture on his pudgy, wobbly feet. Noah pressed himself against Janie, subdued, his head bent down, eyes unreadable beneath half-closed lids. She tried to soak in the warmth of his body against hers. Anderson opened his briefcase and took out a piece of paper.
I have a list of statements that Noah made, if you wouldn't mind going over them to see what corresponds.
Janie glimpsed the page. Noah Zimmerman. Unusual knowledge of reptiles. Can score a baseball game. Likes the baseball team, the Washington Nationals. Speaks of a person named Paulie. Melissa picked it up and looked at it, blinking a few times.
I must admit, I was skeptical when you emailed me. I'm still skeptical. There are so many similarities. And, well, we try to remain open-minded, don't we, John?
John said nothing.
Or at least I do. I've done a lot of soul-searching since...
Her voice trailed off. Janie felt her eyes moving automatically out the window to the covered pool. When she looked at Melissa again, the woman was gazing at her with intense, misty eyes.
I'm glad you're here, she said.
She flicked away a tear and leaped to her feet.
Hey, why don't I go get those cookies? Keep an eye on Charlie, will you, hon?
John nodded curtly.
Excuse me, Anderson said suddenly, standing as well. May I use the... That way.
John nodded in the direction of the hall. Anderson excused himself again, and the room fell into silence. Noah looked at his sneakers. Janie watched the baby try to negotiate the tricky gulf between the couch and the armchair. The baby took a step, wobbled, and fell. He started to cry. John ambled over and picked him up.
Come on now,
he said, jiggling him in an automatic way.
Come on, now.
Anderson walked down the hallway, past a half-open door revealing a pastel yellow room filled with stuffed animals and a crib, and another door, closed, with a sign on it saying, Keep Out, in childish crayon letters. The letters looked cheerful, as if they were really only joking. He paused, glancing in either direction, and then cracked it open. It was a boy's room. It looked like it might have been used yesterday, instead of 5.5 years before. The bedspread, embroidered with baseballs and bats, was tucked neatly under the pillow. The baseball and soccer trophies on the bureau shone in all their fake gold splendor, as if they'd just been won. There was a bin with baseball gloves and another with balls, under a Nationals pennant, and a framed poster of different kinds of snakes. A child's blue backpack sat in the corner, monogrammed T.E.M. It looked to be still filled with schoolbooks. On the bookshelf in the corner of the room, there were a handful of Harry Potter books, along with a baseball encyclopedia and 3 reference books on snakes. Anderson shut the door and hurried to the bathroom. Inside, he locked the door, splashed water on his cheeks, and looked with alarm at the gray face in the mirror. It wasn't them. He had suspected it since the moment they entered the home, but he was sure now. Charlie was a baby, far too young to have been alive during a previous personality's lifetime. There was no way Noah could remember him. Tommy liked snakes, not lizards, and Noah seemed not to recognize any of it. It was the wrong family. It was his fault, of course. His faculties were not fully operational. He couldn't find the word lizards and had written reptiles instead. He hadn't asked the age of the younger brother, Charlie. Small, crucial, uncharacteristic errors that led him in the wrong direction, to disastrous effect. He had been too eager. The forward motion had been so pleasurable to him. He'd almost forgotten about everything that was happening to him in the desire to move and to keep on moving. He ran his hand through his hair. The case was finished. He was finished. His faith in words was shaken at last, and with it all remaining confidence in his professional abilities. What now? He'd erred, and now he'd go into the living room and make it right. And then he'd go home. Go back and resume? No resumption. He was done. That was clear. A fitting end to a long and ignoble career. Oh, but he had worked hard for his obscurity. He leaned against the sink, steeling himself for the inevitable.
Chapter 17. Janie could smell the cookies all the way across the room. "Hope you like 'em warm," Melissa cried, holding the plate aloft like the cover of a book on entertaining. She had emerged from the kitchen cheerful and somehow brighter, her cheeks flushed and her lips newly slathered with pink lipstick. She handed a cookie to Noah and placed the rest of the plate on the side table. The sweet scent masked the citrus and ammonia odor of cleaning supplies and the sour Noah smell that traveled with him everywhere. Janie wondered if the other woman had noticed it. John looked at Melissa over the baby's head.
"Charlie's wet," he said, and made a face.
Melissa laughed sharply. "Well, change him then." The couple's eyes met, and Janie got the distinct impression that more than one dispute had preceded this visit. John sighed. Father and son left the room. Noah sat still on the couch, his hands between his legs, his mouth full of cookie. He wouldn't lift his head. "So," Melissa turned to Janie brightly, "I hear Noah's something of a Nationals fan." "Yes." "Who's your favorite player, Noah?"
"The Zimmernator,"
Noah said to the carpet, his mouth full. "He likes Ryan Zimmerman." "Because of the name, of course," Janie added. But Melissa's eyes widened. "But he was Tommy's favorite, too." At the sound of the name, Noah jerked his head upward. It was impossible not to notice. Melissa turned pale. She looked at Noah. She licked her lips nervously.
Tommy? Are you Tommy?"
He nodded hesitantly.
"Oh, God."
She put her hand over her throat. Her pink smile seemed to float in her face, disembodied, as if it bore no relation to the wet, blinking blue eyes. Was Janie dreaming? Was this actually happening?
"Tommy, come here,"
the other mother was saying. Her white arms were wide.
"Come to Mommy."
Noah gaped at her. The woman crossed the small distance between them and pulled him up out of the chair, lifting his body into her arms like a rag doll. But it couldn't be, Janie thought. He had the same rash on his arms that she had on hers. She had held him moments after his birth upon her breast, and he had suckled instantly, like an old pro, the nurse had said proudly.
"Oh, my baby boy."
Melissa started to cry into Noah's hair.
"I'm so sorry."
"Oh,"
Noah said. His forehead was turning pink above her arms, and the word emerged from him like a peep. When he was pulled out of Janie's body, the doctor had held him high up so she could see him. He was still attached by the umbilical cord, smeared with blood and traces of white vernix. His face was deep red, contorted, beautiful.
"I am so, so sorry, baby. I made a mistake," Melissa said.
Her voice was rough. The mascara started to roll down her face.
"I know I messed up. I always check the latch. I thought I'd checked it. I messed up."
Janie could barely see the top of Noah's head. She couldn't see his face.
"Oh," he peeped again. "Oh, I left the latch open. I never do that. Oh, I messed up."
She clutched at his arms, which lay rigid on either side of him, and his skin mottled beneath her fingers, becoming as bright as his red Nationals t-shirt.
"But why did you drown, baby?"
"Why, you had swimming lessons."
"Oh,"
Noah said. Only he wasn't saying, "Oh," Janie realized suddenly. He was saying, "No."
"No,"
Noah said again. He craned his neck to shake his head free, and she could see that his eyes were screwed tightly shut. He squirmed, but could not get out of the other woman's embrace.
No, no, no!
I didn't know you'd go to the pool, Melissa was saying breathlessly. I never knew you'd do that.
But you could swim. You could swim. Oh, God, I messed up. Tommy, Mommy messed up.
She reached up to wipe her eyes with her hands, and Noah wrenched himself loose. He backed up across the living room. He was shaking so violently his teeth chattered. Janie moved toward him.
Noah, are you okay?
Tommy.
Melissa reached out with her soft white arms. He looked from one woman to the other.
Go away!
He screamed.
Go away!
He moved as far away from both of them as he could, toppling the side table, spilling the cookies onto the floor.
Where's my mama?
He shouted, turning to Janie.
You said I was going to see my mama! You said!
Noah, Janie said, sweetie, look. But he shut his eyes and put his hands over his ears and began to hum loudly to himself. Anderson rushed into the room, followed by John, holding the baby, who was wearing only a diaper. John took in the scene, looking first at Noah, then his wife, the tears like tire tracks down the sides of her face.
What have you done? He said.
In the kitchen, Noah sat at the table with his eyes closed and his hands over his ears. He was still humming. He wouldn't look at Janie. When she put her hand on his shoulder, he wriggled away. Another tray of cookies sat on the gleaming marble counter. Their smell permeated the room, powerful and nauseating. Like a mistake it was too late to fix. Anderson cleared his throat. Janie could hardly look at him.
It was an error.
He seemed to be addressing all of them, or none of them. It seems to be the wrong previous personality. Nobody answered him. Let me explain, he said, but didn't continue. He seemed to have lost his bearings, if he had ever truly had any. Melissa was slumped at the other end of the table. She had bitten her lip, and now it was bleeding. There was a smudge of blood on the collar of her yellow blouse, a smear on her white teeth. I thought I was going to get some answers, she mumbled. Janie could see a streak of gray mixed in with the blonde sweep of her hair. Her husband had a packet of baby wipes in his hand and was cleaning her face, the baby tucked under his arm like a giant squirming football.
There are no answers, John said. It was an accident.
He gently wiped the black marks from the sides of her face and her chin. She let him, her hands dangling loosely in her lap. As he cleared the makeup, she looked even younger, like a child.
You always say that, Melissa moaned. But it's my fault.
The pool boy left the latch open.
The baby started to wail.
You know this. It could have happened to anybody. It was a fluke.
But the lessons.
He wasn't a strong swimmer.
But if I had checked the latch.
It's time to stop this, Mel.
Time to stop this. The words woke Janie at last from her spell. This woman has lost her son, she thought.
She lost her son.
She let the words sink in. She saw, she couldn't help but see, a sweet-looking blonde child struggling at the bottom of the pool, his small dead body floating in that crystal blue water. A dead child. Everything flowed from that fact, didn't it? Of all the bad things that could happen, that was the worst. And then, they had come here and done this thing to her. This woman, who had already suffered unimaginably, they had gotten her hopes up and then had dashed them bitterly, and whether they had meant to or not was beside the point. She had done this thing. She couldn't blame Noah. And Anderson had followed the dictates of his own ethics in a way she couldn't truly fathom. But she was a mother and should have known better. And instead she had been cruel to this woman. It was unconscionable what she had done, and all because she couldn't face the truth. Which was? That Tommy Moran had died and wasn't coming back. And Anderson's case was finished, and Noah was sick. It's time to stop this. The baby was still wailing.
Mel.
The husband was stroking her head like a puppy. Charlie's hungry.
He needs you.
Melissa took the baby from her husband mechanically. She pulled up her shirt and bra with a quick, deft gesture, and her round breast popped into view, its large pink nipple as unexpected as a spaceship. Janie felt Anderson avert his gaze, but she couldn't look away. Melissa settled the hungry baby on her breast, and after a few moments her face took on a quieter expression. Shame trickled down Janie's neck. She had put Noah through this, too, confusing him even further for no good reason. "I'm sorry," she said to Melissa. Melissa closed her eyes, focusing on what was happening in her body, and Janie remembered the prickling sensation of breasts becoming heavy and alive with the flow of milk, the tug at the nipple with small, sharp teeth, and then the deep inner sigh as the baby sucked the milk into his mouth.
"You people ought to leave now," John said,
though it hardly needed saying. He led them silently through the house, Janie steering Noah with both hands on his back, his hands still covering his ears. Anderson followed behind. John opened the front door. He wouldn't look at them. The three of them stumbled down the steps and out into the pretty street. Trees waved in the breeze. The golf courses glowed in the distance. A boy on a bike whizzed by them on the sidewalk, ferociously focused, nearly hitting them. Janie watched him continue down the street, tires wobbling. They drove away in silence. Janie sat in the back next to Noah's car seat. Noah wouldn't open his eyes or remove his hands from his ears. After a while, his hands fell to his sides, and she realized he had fallen asleep. "Noah is sick." She tried the words out in her head. They lay there meaninglessly, like an innocent-looking chunk of plutonium. Anderson turned down one street and then another, and the guard waved them out the gate. They were back in the world now, the confusing, hectic reality. They turned down Main Street toward the motel. The GPS lady sang her indifferent tune, "Continue 0.2 miles, then turn left on Pleasant Street." Pleasant, Janie thought. The word echoed in her brain, transformed into psychosis. Out the window, the local high school was getting out for the day. Big kids slouching toward the parking lot, calling out to each other with loud, exuberant voices. "Turn left on Psychosis Street." "Recalculating." "Recalculating." "Medicating." "Continue 0.2 miles on Psychosis Street." "Medicating." "Medicating." They were going down a side street now, past a local bank, a sweet street with smaller houses, their porches adorned with American flags. Side street. Side effects. "Continue 0.3 miles. Turn left on Catherine Place." "Catherine. Catatonic." "Turn left on Catatonic Place." "Medicating." Anderson was looking at her in the rearview mirror.
"Janie, I must apologize," he said quietly. "It clearly wasn't the right previous personality. I should have caught that. There were things I missed I should not have missed."
"Things?" Janie tried to shake her head clear.
"Yes, the younger son, Charlie. He is too young for Tommy to have known him. I thought they had an older child named Charlie."
"How do you stop trying when it is your son? But it has to stop somewhere. It's time to stop this." "Turn left on Denial Road. Medicating, medicating." Car seemed to be roaming the streets with a will of its own. Anderson was still speaking.
"And I used the word reptiles. I should have said lizards. It is my mistake. It's not like me, but that's no excuse. I was not being precise. I didn't catch the difference between snakes and liz-" "Jerry, stop the car."
He pulled to the side of the road. He faced the front, beads of sweat glistening on the back of his neck.
"Yes?
We're done here, Jerry."
"I agree. Definitely this was the wrong home."
"Was the man dense?"
"No, I mean, I'm done with schools and stores and houses, all of it.
Please drive us to the motel."
"That's where we're going."
"The GPS said left. You turned right 3 times, actually." He frowned.
No.
Why do you think she keeps saying recalculating?
Oh.
His hands were white-knuckled on the steering wheel.
Oh.
He looked through the windshield, as if lost at sea. She tried to keep her own voice cool. Jerry, listen to me. There is no previous personality. Noah made it all up. Anderson kept his gaze fixed in front of him, as if the answers lay there, on the asphalt road.
What do you mean?
She looked at her sleeping boy. He was slumped in his car seat, his shining head tilted on one shoulder, pale lashes fluttering. She could see the seatbelt making a mark where it crossed his cheek. He made it up. Because he has schizophrenia, she said. She had said it. That word that sounded like every bodily function run amok at the same time. She opened the car door and stepped out on the road. She leaned down, hands on her knees, sequestered behind a dense curtain of hair. The vertigo was too strong. She kneeled at the edge of the road. She felt it hard and firm beneath her, like reality.
Are you all right?
He was shading his eyes and looked unsteady on his feet. People like the two of them, desperate people, were dangerous, she thought suddenly. She saw the other mother, the black tear tracks on her face. She felt sick again, this time with guilt. Yet, some part of her, she realized, was also relieved. That door was closed. She was back in real life again. However terrible that might be. Anderson wiped his face with his hand.
You've had a diagnosis,
he said at last. She looked around, as if wanting someone to contradict this. The grass, the asphalt, the cars whizzing by on their way to the supermarket or the mall. Yes. He shook his head.
Who?
Not exactly a diagnosis, a suggestion. By Dr. Remsen. He's a child psychiatrist in New York. One of the best, apparently. This last she threw out to hurt him. He took this in without reacting.
Why didn't you tell me?
I guess I was afraid you wouldn't want to work with us. His eyes flashed.
Don't you know what my colleagues would say if...
He inhaled slowly, and with an effort lowered his voice again.
You...
His lip trembled a little, then stilled. There was a cost, she thought, to calming that facade.
You should have told me.
I don't care about your colleagues, she thought. I don't care what happens after people die. I care about the boy in the car. That's all I've ever cared about. Yes, I should have told you, she admitted, dully. When your son is very sick, you're not yourself. You don't behave in ordinary ways. You can't see clearly. She wiped her wet eyes with her hand. It was irresponsible of me. She meant all of it. He shook his head sharply.
Noah doesn't have schizophrenia, Anderson said.
She felt the hope begin to buzz up inside of her, and she smashed it fast before it could do any more damage. And you know this how?
It's my professional opinion.
She stood up and smiled thinly at him. I'm sorry, but that doesn't carry a lot of weight with me right now. She ignored his wince. Besides, you saw Noah's behavior today.
It was the wrong previous personality.
Anderson bowed his head.
It was my fault. It's upsetting, but it's over.
The case is finished, Jerry.
Yes, of course.
He nodded slowly.
Of course. I just need a...
he said. Then he walked a few feet away into the grass and looked around him as if to find his way.
Mom?
Noah was waking up. He stretched and cast a shattering smile in her direction. How are you feeling, sweetie? She smoothed his hair, rubbed the red mark from the seatbelt on his face. Are you hungry? I have a granola bar in my purse. He smiled sleepily.
Are we there yet?
We're almost to the motel.
No, Mommy Mom,
he said patiently, as if she were daft.
When do we get to Asheville Road?
Sujith Jayaratne, a boy from a suburb of the Sri Lankan capital Colombo, began showing an intense fear of trucks and even the word lorry, a British word for truck that has become part of the Sinhalese language, when he was only 8 months old. When he became old enough to talk, he said that he had lived in Gorakhana, a village 7 miles away, and that he had died after being hit by a truck. He made numerous statements about that life. His great-uncle, a monk at a nearby temple, heard some of them and mentioned Sujith to a younger monk at the temple. The story interested this monk, so he talked with Sujith, who was a little more than 2.5 years old at the time, about his memories and then wrote up notes of the conversations before he attempted to verify any of the statements. His notes document that Sujith said that he was from Gorakhana and lived in the section of Gorakhawate, that his father was named Jamis and had a bad right eye, that he had attended the Kabal Iskole, which means dilapidated school, and had a teacher named Francis there, and that he gave money to a woman named Kusum, who prepared string hoppers, a type of food, for him. He said that his house was whitewashed, that its lavatory was beside a fence, and that he bathed in cool water. Sujith had also told his mother and grandmother a number of other things about the previous life that no one wrote down until after the previous personality had been identified. He said his name was Sammy, and he sometimes called himself Gorakhana Sammy. He said that his wife's name was Maggie, and their daughter's was Nandini. He had worked for the railways and had once climbed Adam's Peak, a high mountain in central Sri Lanka. He said that on the day he died, he and Maggie had quarreled. She left the house, and he then went out to the store. While he was crossing the road, a truck ran over him, and he died. The young monk went to Gorakhana to look for a family who had a deceased member whose life matched Sujith's statements. After some effort, he discovered that a 50-year-old man named Sammy Fernando, or Gorakhana Sammy, as he was sometimes called, had died after being hit by a truck 6 months before Sujith was born. All of Sujith's statements proved to be correct for Sammy Fernando, except for his statement that he had died immediately when the truck hit him. Sammy Fernando died 1 to 2 hours after being admitted to a hospital following the accident. Jim B. Tucker, M.D. Life Before Life.
Chapter 18. Denise woke up with the name on her lips, the taste of it in her mouth, briny and bitter, like earth and sea at the same time. She allowed herself 10 seconds to lie there, which was about 7 seconds too long, and then got herself up out of that bed. She dressed carefully, making sure she did the buttons the right way on her blouse and her blazer, checking her stockings to be sure that there were no runs, pulling and twisting her hair back into a bun and clipping it so that it would stay put. The dress code at the home was relaxed to the point of ludicrous. Jeans and tracksuits, for goodness sakes. But she had dressed professionally all her life, even in those early years as a student teacher, and she surely wasn't about to stop now. Besides, it was important for the patients and their families. It sent a message of respect. She made the bed, collected her night clothes, and put them in the hamper, and only then allowed herself to head to the bathroom. Hidden above the sink, behind the aspirin and tampons, was the bottle of pills Dr. Ferguson had given her. She took out a pill and cut it in fourths with the butter knife she kept on the shelf. Even a half gave her a loose, slightly dizzy feeling she didn't like, and a whole one made her foggy all day. But a quarter was usually enough. She gulped it dry and put the bottle back carefully, closing the cabinet until it clicked. There. And there she was. That familiar blur of skin and wet brown eyes and black hair. Her hair was going back at the roots. She was way past due at the hair salon. She wished she could do what plenty of other black women did and just shave it close to her head and let it be. She couldn't help staring when she saw women with hair like that, marveling at the simplicity, the sleekness, the lack of fuss. She herself wouldn't have felt right with a look like that, though,
would have felt unprepared. Downstairs, she started the coffee and turned on the radio, broke some eggs on the frying pan. She heard Charlie thumping around upstairs, doing whatever 15-year-olds did in the morning. Couldn't take him but a moment to throw on a t-shirt and some jeans. Charlie! Breakfast! She stood watching the eggs in the pan and listening to the news on the radio, leaning against the counter. Outside the kitchen window, Denise saw a layer of frost gleaming on the stubble of the newly planted cornfields. It had been a long winter, and it kept on coming, continuing its victory laps halfway into spring. In their yard, a lone bird tried and tried again to drink from the half-frozen birdbath. Charlie pounded down the stairs. Always a shock to her that this huge body with its bouncing dreads could have come from her slight frame. That he was hers, this hulking form that passed quickly in and out of her day. He sprawled onto a kitchen chair and started banging out a beat on the table with his knife and fork. She placed a plate of steaming eggs in front of him and sat down. Made you some eggs. Thanks, Mama. He jumped up to pour himself some juice. Charlie, sit, you're making my head spin. You sleep okay? That dog keep you up again? She paused. Had she called out again in her sleep? Is that why he was asking? I slept fine. Good. He slammed down in his seat. No, Charlie hadn't heard a thing. She exhaled quietly. This didn't mean she hadn't yelled out, of course. She sat still, listening to the sound of the radio without focusing on the words. The pill was kicking in. She allowed herself to fall into the cadences of the voice. A man's voice, oozing sanity and sameness, smoothing out the wars and the earthquakes and the hurricanes with its peaceful and predictable rhythms. The world could end. It did end. And you could count on that voice still being there to tell you how it all went down. Mama? I was asking if there's any bacon left. She made herself stand and felt dizzy. She opened the refrigerator door and stood there for a moment, holding on to it, looking inside at the bright, cool things. There it was, the shiny package. She took it out. Don't talk with your mouth full. She made her way to the stove, placed the bacon on the pan. It sizzled, spitting tiny droplets of oil on her good brown skirt. She knew the second the first waft of it hit her, she wasn't going to be able to eat a bite herself. She hadn't realized how unappetizing bacon could be. The news finished, and some classical music came on. She always put the radio on the classical station when Charlie was around. She thought it was good for him to hear it. The same way she watched the news programs or nature documentaries at night, when he was home, when what she really would have liked was one of those reality soap operas, the escape of watching rich, silly people behave badly. Dr. Ferguson thought that after everything that had happened, she might loosen up about these kinds of things. But it had gone the other way. She wrapped the bacon in a paper towel and carried the thing to Charlie's plate, dumping the glistening sticks on top of the eggs, and sank back into her chair. You're not eating, Mama? Wait, don't you have your civics test this morning? We didn't go over. That was Friday. But I think I did pretty good. Charlie Crawford. Did well. I think I did well. Is that how you talk in English class? Is that why she gave you a C+? He ducked his head and began shoveling the bacon into his mouth. No, 'cause you know you need to do better than that if you want to get into a good college. That's what the college counselor, I got it under control. He glanced up at her, then down at his plate again, scraping up the rest of his food. Who knew what the truth was? Charlie had always been a pretty good student, but kids that age were unpredictable once the hormones started hitting. Maria Clifford's son, down the road, had gone from the honor roll to flunking out and working at the gas station as soon as you could bat an eye. Here, Mama, have some bacon. It's good. He dumped a morsel on the table.